Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to revisit our conversation from July with Timothy Weingard, talking about his book, The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity. Horses revolutionized the way we hunted, traded, traveled, farmed, fought, worshipped, and interacted. They fundamentally reshaped the human genome and the world's linguistic map. They determined international borders, molded cultures, fueled economies, and built global superpowers. And they decided the destinies of conquerors and empires. They also were vectors of lethal disease and contributed to life-saving medical innovations. Horses even inspired architecture, invention, furniture, and fashion. We'll talk with Timothy Weingard. His book is The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity, following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Timothy Weingard about his new book, The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity. Horses revolutionized the way we hunted, traded, traveled, farmed, fought, worshipped, and interacted. They fundamentally reshaped the human genome and the world's linguistic map. They determined international borders, molded cultures, fueled economies, and built global superpowers. They decided the destinies of conquerors and empires. They were vectors of lethal disease and contributed to life-saving medical innovations. Horses even inspired agriculture, invention, furniture, and fashion. To know the horse is to understand the world. Dr. Timothy Weingard is a New York Times bestselling author of 5 books, including The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. He holds a PhD from University of Oxford, served as officer in Canadian and British armies, and has appeared on numerous documentaries, television programs, and podcasts. He's associate professor of history at Colorado Mesa University. Timothy Weingard, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So we talked a couple of years ago about the Mosquito book. I was interested to learn from the acknowledgments how this book came to pass. I guess it's how all the books come to pass. You sit down and brainstorm with your dad. That's a great way to do things.
Yeah, he's an emergency physician back home in Canada, but he's a big history buff and reads a lot and has his Jedi wisdom, obviously, to pass on to me. So this horse book is my 6th book. So every time I finish a book, we sit down and just brainstorm topics. And the last couple books, I wanted to write about something global, big, and that everybody across the planet could identify with. So that's how the Mosquito book, the previous book, came about, and certainly this horse book as well. And now, thankfully, the horse is a little bit more of an enjoyable and lovable creature than the mosquito was as a topic to research and write about, and certainly for readers. So thankfully, all human beings love horses, which is a good thing.
Mm. So this is the subtitle is interesting, A Galloping History of Humanity. So, you know, humanity seen through the lens of the horse, this partnership. That's kind of the central premise, right? That just about everything in civilization, how we progress as humanity, can be seen as being driven by the horse, seen through that lens.
Yeah, it's a different way to look at human history. The book is a history book about how the horse influenced and shaped the trajectory of our global civilization and the modern world order. And I can certainly say if we removed the horse from our historical trails and our epic sagas, our modern world would be turned upside down and look completely different. And you can't say that about many things that impact and influence history. So, I mean, prior to the domestication of the horse, roughly 3500 BCE, we only had our own 2 feet, whether that's for agriculture, trade, traction, warfare. So the horse is a revolution in human civilization and hauls into place the fundamental and foundational building blocks of our society across the planet. So it really is, you can't have human history without horse history. We're intertwined. And the human horse dyad is the most powerful animal coalition ever witnessed.
So you write in the introduction that thought experiment that you just referenced. Internal combustion engines only been with us about 100 years, right? The horse 5,000 previous. And you only have to imagine, what if we had no internal combustion engine And you want to go do something. Well, as far as your feet can take you.
Yeah, and we forget that we have short memories. We forget that really the horse was only unseated by the internal combustion engine roughly 100 years ago. But before that, it dominated all aspects of human civilization for 5,500 years. And it's amazing then to look at history through that lens, just how important horses were for agriculture, population growth, migration, travel, trade, not just of trade goods, but of ideas, of diseases, of innovations, of, academia, and then certainly as a weapon system with horse and chariot, and then eventually with the Assyrians beginning around 800 BC, the rise of modern cavalry, it fundamentally changes the rules to the game of life.
You're right that, and I'd never thought about this. So, when did the first human get on the back of a horse? You talked to an expert who said it was almost certainly a stupid teenager.
Yeah, well, that's the story we think, because by 4000 BCE, horses had gone extinct across the planet, save for a small secluded pocket of the Eurasian steppe grasslands. Now, the horse is actually the epicenter of equine evolution is in North America, specifically Utah, Colorado, Montana, this area of the world. And so this is where the horse evolved from a 10-pound fox-like creature into the mighty, beautiful, majestic animal we have today. And it obviously, through evolution, they would migrate across the Bering Strait land bridge to Eurasia and continue to develop and die off. But by 4000 BCE, the horse went extinct in the Americas roughly 9000 years ago, along with a lot of other large megafauna, including 500-pound beavers, giant ground sloths, mastodons, woolly mammoths, 4000-pound short-faced bears. So by 4000 BCE, it had gone extinct across the entire planet. So it's a late addition to our collection of barnyard domesticates. And really, it was probably a hunter or some young kid on a dare who decided to jump on the back of a wounded mare or a docile mare. And this is the, if apocryphal story of how horses were at least first tamed and then domesticated north of the Black Sea in what is now the Ukraine, southern Russia, and Kazakhstan.
And I guess we suppose this because this is became a huge animal, big animal, potentially dangerous. only somebody who doesn't fear their own mortality would jump on the back of that thing, I guess.
Right. I mean, it's still a 1,000-pound giant wild animal. Now, horses are unique in that they don't have sharp claws or horns of any kind, or really sharp teeth. Males have canine teeth, females don't. So they're evolved specifically for flight and not fight, which is a benefit to humanity, because from an evolutionary standpoint in the animal world, horses are a unique and rare blend of strength, speed, and stamina, as well as size. So, I mean, it's amazing any of us survived into adulthood with our just because logic as adolescents.
So I was talking to a friend the other day, we got talking about horses, and he's had some experience. I don't have hardly any. He said, the back hooves could hurt you, the front hooves, how a horse would kill you. I don't know if that's, but, they do have some defenses.
Yeah, so females actually generally kick with their hind legs as they spray urine in the eyes of what would be an attacker, and then obviously run away. And stallions are more likely to rear with their front legs, and they can also bite as well. They do have canines, but generally speaking, which is why they're such a utilitarian animal for all human pursuits, is they're designed for flight and not fight, which is why they become the premier sidekick to humanity across our last 5,000 years of existence.
Really? So a mare would spray urine to blind you?
Yes, as she's kicking with her back legs, and then running, obviously, then running away, because that's what they're designed to do, is run, not necessarily fight.
Yeah, interesting. So tell me more about the evolution. You say the horse started in this area of the world. Speaking from Utah, Colorado, size of a fox?
Yeah, it's roughly a 10-pound animal with four toes and three toes on its hind and front legs. It's called a Hybracotherium, roughly 10 pounds, the size of a fox, and it bounds more like a deer than gallops like a horse. And it doesn't eat grass at this point. It eats, shrubbery, leaves, berries. And then what happens is these forests give way to grasslands. And so from an environmental pressure of food sustenance, we gradually see the horse get bigger and also start eating grass over the 60 million years of evolution, of which the epicenter of equine horse evolution is this part, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming of North America. And then various species of equus go over both land bridges, because at some point you could actually cross via Canada, Greenland, Scandinavia into Eurasia, or the other way through what is now the Bering Strait, where they continue to evolve and die off. But the main evolution of the modern horse, there's only one species of horse on the planet, takes place here over 60 million years in, as I said, this kind of southwest United States.
I was reading an interview you gave, I think, to local Grand Junction paper or the Colorado Mesa. You said from childhood you'd have had a question: how do horses get so big and muscular and powerful by basically just eating grass? So did you find the answer to that question?
I did, through my research. As a kid, my parents would take me to the local petting zoo with the Orwellian nickname, the Animal Farm. And so I would stare at the horses in amazement, because as a kid, I wanted to be a hockey player, obviously, coming from Canada. They'd be like, you have to eat your protein to get big muscles, as we all know. And I'd stare at these horses who are just, jacked and huge, muscular, amazing physiques. And I would wonder, how do these animals get so big if they just eat grass? And I'm a big Star Wars fan, so I liken it to when Yoda first meets Luke in Dagobah. In Empire Strikes Back, when Yoda tastes this kind of crackers and he says, how you get so big eating food of this kind? So I did answer my child nagging boyhood question. And it's largely, again, down to evolution and the shift from browsing on fruits and shrubberies to grass. The horse develops a very unique set of teeth, a very unique muzzle, which pushes the eyes back and up on its head. And then it has a very different digestive system than the rest of the ruminants, like cows and deer, for example. It's a hindgut digester and something called a cecum. So its ability to turn the grass into usable nutrients, or the bacteria in its stomach as well into usable nutrients, is part of its evolution and why it could get so big.
Before humans rode horses, I guess it was the horse was just like any other barnyard animal. The humans got milk, right? Ate horses, I guess?
Yeah, so like the rest of our barnyard collection, horses were first domesticated, and we know this through archaeological evidence, in that area, what I call the Pontic Caspian Steppe, north of the Black Sea in Ukraine, southern Russia, Kazakhstan. They were first domesticated as a literal livestock for their meat, their milk, and then the secondary products made out of their hooves, hides, even their dung was used as insulation for these houses, as well as for fuel, very similar to bison chips out on the Great Plains here with indigenous peoples. So they were first raised as a livestock of meat, milk, and secondary products. And quickly humanity realized the unlimited potential of this animal for every application we could think to use it for, specifically farming, so traction, trade, migration, and certainly warfare.
I want to go back briefly. You said that the horse is almost extinct or heading that way before humans domesticated and started riding them?
Yeah, so it had gone extinct across the entire planet due to environmental pressures, including North America, the entire Americas. It went extinct in the Americas roughly 9,000 years ago. If we look at the other barnyard animal domesticates, they were all domesticated somewhere between 8,000 and 6,000 BCE, whereas the horse was domesticated roughly 3,500 BCE. And that's simply because it didn't really exist anymore, except in this very small, barren landscape, cold, barren landscape of this piece of the Eurasian steppe, grasslands. So it was a later addition to our domesticates. And likely it was, there's a hypothesis that it was saved from extinction completely because of domestication.
So after that first person got on the back of that first horse, I imagine that, you know, the advantages were obvious, right? And it exploded from there. And humans and horses formed what you call the Centaurian Pact. And that's affected just about everything.
Yeah, and as I mentioned in the book, when you think about combining the strength, speed, stamina, and size of a horse with the intelligence and ability to manipulate of a human being, the horse literally and figuratively raises the potential of our species. And so we see civilization profoundly change with the domestication of the horse in all aspects of humanity. People, priorly unknown, you know, groups of people are meeting each other. They're trading with each other. They're sharing ideas. They're sharing pathogens. They're sharing spirituality. They're sharing culture. They're sharing DNA. They're sharing languages. And so some of these first generations of domesticated horses, the first people to domesticate horses are known as Indo-Europeans, and no one else has horses. So they quickly spread out across Eurasia, and they're a very patriarchal, militant culture, and they cement their own linguistics and DNA from the Atlantic Ocean in Europe through the Indian subcontinent all the way to Western China. And this is why 48% of the planet currently speaks an Indo-European language, or a dialect of their original language. English is a Indo-European language. So they also cement their DNA. If you look at Europeans now, almost 100% of their Y chromosomes come from these original horse riders coming, spilling out of the Eurasian steppe and conquering Europe in what was not a benign process. It also leads to the Indian caste system. When these Indo-Europeans, because Indian languages, Iranian languages, they're all Indo-European languages as well, just they're related to English. So when they get to India, again, they implant and cement their culture, and it leads to the Indian caste system as well. So it has a profound impact even on our modern world today, immediately upon domestication, 5,500 years ago in this barren landscape north of the Black Sea. And that's just one example of the profound impact horses have had, not only in the immediacy of their domestication, but that it still has current implications and ripple effects. We're conducting this interview in English, which is an Indo-European language. It's their language, thanks to the horse.
Yeah, interesting to think about. You also say the internal combustion engine. I think we've focus on that, rightly so. It's had a profound effect, but the changes, the effect, the impacts of internal combustion engine, you write, are just carrying on from the same impacts that the horse had. And the internal combustion engine's 100 years, the horse, 5,000 years.
Yeah, the internal combustion engine, or automobiles, planes, trains, automobiles, if you will, really just rode the tails of the horse. It made things faster, obviously. It made things a little bit more accessible. It made distances smaller. But the horse had done all of those things prior to the internal combustion engine. And even when we look at the infrastructure shift from horse-powered cities to gas-powered cities, it really is quite a simple transition because the roads are already there. The infrastructure is already there for horse traffic or horse transportation, and that shift to cars is relatively painless. And certainly I think the horse is appreciative of the internal combustion engine, because as much as we think of the horse as an organic animal, it's also a living machine. and certainly was not treated with the utmost care or respect in a lot of professions that we conscripted this magnificent animal into.
I'll just quote you from the book. Imagine for a moment our human odyssey and epic sagas without the historical power of horses. I can safely say that our modern world order and socio-cultural configurations would be completely unrecognizable. We might as well live on another planet in a galaxy far, far away. So I'll just ask you to briefly, you know, to expand on that counterfactual. What if we'd never domesticated the horse? We never rode the horse. Maybe the horse went extinct like so many others. What would life be like?
Well, it's certainly what if history, and I can't answer this, would all be hypothetical, of course. But I think what we see is we would still be confined to relatively small groups of humanity living in small isolated pockets of the planet. There wouldn't have been the ability to reach out and touch someone that the horse provided us. So when we think of ancient empires, those would have been impossible. The horse allowed, whether it's the Assyrian Empire, Alexander's Empire, the Roman Empire, the Mongol Empire, the horse allowed, you know, avaricious conquerors to take and hold empires, vast empires. And it's not strictly from a military standpoint, because what this does is when our global village becomes increasingly smaller because of the horse, we share ideas. And when human beings share ideas on a global level, which is what the horse allowed us to do, we have advancement in all fields and arenas of academia, spirituality, across the board. So we see a rise in science, we see a rise in agricultural technology, which allows for the increase of human populations and population densities. We see a rise in the arts, in more sophisticated spirituality. So this is all stemming from the ability of the horse to connect people, places, ideas, pathogens, and most of it is the spread of ideas, and that is a remarkable thing. So if we look backwards, we have the internet now, and before that we had the printing press. But the horse is along the same line or the same vein of allowing people to have information or access information at a quicker speed and in more abundance.
Let's take a brief break. When we come back, we'll have more with Timothy Weingard. His new book is called The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity. It's out and available out tomorrow, I think, is the launch.
It's available for pre-order, you know, anywhere on the internet, but it officially comes out tomorrow, yes.
Yeah, so great book, well worth the read. The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity, that's what we're talking about today. We'll have more following this break.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest today is Timothy Weingard. He is Associate Professor of History at Colorado Mesa University, author of several books, New York Times bestselling author of The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator, the previous book. The new book is a fascinating book. It's called The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity. So, Timothy Weingard, I was interested in this passage. You say that the horse, it turned out, became, I'm trying to pull this up here, eventually horses became a relatively democratic resource. I guess this could have gone in a different direction if horses were different, I suppose. And the predilection, the way this often goes, is resources are closely guarded by the rich, right? But the horse, you know, has pulled the cart of the poor man as well as the carriage of the king.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. And I think that's why it has such an influential impact on our history. And on the trajectory of our history is because it was a ubiquitous animal that belonged to everybody. Horses belong to all human beings. And that's been the case since, you know, shortly after domestication. We see the horse spread very quickly across all cultures of Eurasia, from China to Europe to India to the Middle East, specifically because it allowed humans to break the chains, if you will, of not having so much mobility. So it is democratic in the fact, I mean, certainly there are regimes throughout history of who have tried to limit The transference of horses to cultures who don't have them, because it's such a benefit in warfare. And we certainly see that with the Columbian Exchange. When Europeans colonized the Americas, there's laws passed to prohibit indigenous peoples from owning horses or riding horses, because it was such a fundamental element of the ability of Europeans to conquer these indigenous peoples who did not have horses, along with disease, for sure, as we know from Jared Diamond's famous trifecta of guns, germs, and steel. I add horses to that as far as the colonization of the planet, including the Americas. But people could capture horses, people could steal horses, horses ran away, and there were feral herds, you know, throughout the world. So it becomes a very democratic element of society, because it proffered human beings with liberty, and it afforded them freedom across the board, whether that's to move, migration, that as an economic tool. And we see this even with, in times where women certainly did not have the agency that men had, we see this with the horse. The Amazons are real. They're a group of people on the Eurasian steppe, a group of Scythian peoples who were ruled by women, and it's a very, very matriarchal society, and they are a fully equestrian culture. And in fact, Cyrus the Great, the founder of the mighty Persian Empire that comes before Alexander the Great and his empire, was killed by Queen Tomyris of these Amazons, and his head was turned into a gilded drinking cup. So we do, and we see this in China as well, with women rising into the ranks of Chinese cavalry in early dynastic China. So it was freedom in a 1,000-pound animal.
That's still the case, right? That's the image of the horse, freedom.
I think right. It is, and I half joke about Chevy and Ford truck commercials. They're always showing some beautiful maned horse running through the majestic landscapes of America, and that the horse is equivalent to, you know, not only the power of pickup trucks, but the freedom that they offer. And so we still invoke this image of the horse representing freedom. And interestingly enough, I know the Olympics are on now in Paris, and people are tuning in, and obviously the equestrian events. The horse is obviously the only non-human animal that participates in the Olympics. But also, if you look at equestrian, males and females participate in the same events. It's not separate events for the different genders, which is another very unique thing about the Olympics with the equestrian events, is that everything's on a level playing field. And that's a very good example of what the horse does on a larger scale, or on a macro scale, to our civilizations, as this, you know, vehicle of freedom in so many avenues.
I want to pause here. I learned a lot in the book, but the opening little part is called Everything Equus. You lay out some terms and such. Explain to me hands. You hear this. Horses, so many hands high, but tell me about that.
the hand is the measurement of a horse, of how tall it is from the withers, which is the right below the neck, is the tallest part of its back. So where the neck and back kind of join down to the ground, that's where it's measured from. So originally it literally would have been the width of a human hand. So we measure horses and hands. Now a hand is 4 inches. It was standardized by King Henry VIII of England, where a hand represents 4 inches. So that's how we measure horses. Now most horses you would see, you know, from a recreational horse, are these anywhere from 15 to 17 hands. General Grant's horse, Cincinnati, was over 17 hands, and that's a big horse. So kind of 15 to 17 hands would be the average horse now. During Roman times, they were roughly 14 to 15 hands, certainly plenty big enough to ride or use for pull wagons or carts or whatever else you're using plows the horse for.
No, pony is just a horse who's shorter, I guess. Is that the case?
Yeah, pony is a horse that's under 14 hands. There's only one species of horse on the planet, Equus caballus. All the other species of Equus died out, so of the horse lineage. So there's seven species currently. There's three species of ass, three species of zebras, in relation to the horse and one species of horse. Now, the Przewalski's horse, which there's a roughly 2,000 of them on the planet, they're squat, kind of stout-looking horses with a big head and a big neck and a weird mane, sometimes called the Mongol horse or the Dzungarian horse. They're from the eastern steppe of Mongolia and China. Now, they're a subspecies of the main line of horses. They're not their own species, even though they have two more chromosomes, is because they can reproduce with the Kabylie horse to produce fertile offspring. So they're likely a subspecies and not a separate species of the horse line.
Mm. By the way, again, parenthetically, inside of parenthetically, Przewalski, that's how you say that?
Yeah, Przewalski. It's a Polish... It comes from a Polish explorer who allegedly found these horses in the wild. So it's named after him. He was Polish, but in the Russian military, and he came across these horses in Mongolia and China, and so they bear his name. But it's pronounced Przewalski, even though the spelling is a little bit interesting.
Yeah, that's what I was commenting on. Is PRZ something? I guess I still have to learn my Polish pronunciation.
Very long Polish name, but Przewalski, yes.
Przewalski, yeah. Interesting, yeah. This is we think that this is essentially the same or similar species.
Yeah, subspecies of the Kabylie horse, yeah, of the yeah. only species, okay. Because there's 64 chromosomes versus 66, but they can mate to produce fertile offspring. So there's some. I mean, the taxonomists of the world argue about whether it's a separate species or the same species or a subspecies, but generally the consensus is it's a subspecies of Equus caballus, which is the only species of horse.
Mm-hmm. Now, your definition of a Mustang, wild, in quotation marks, horse of the American West, from the Spanish Mustenio. So wild, these are, I guess, feral, but it's the same... It's the same species, right? They just escaped.
Yeah, so there's no true, by definition, wild horses left on the planet, including the Przewalski horses that they're reintroducing in Kazakhstan, Mongolia, China. Now, they were bred from captive. There was roughly 12 to 20 of these Przewalski's horses left in captivity that had been tamed and domesticated, and they're bred and being re-released. So the wild horses or Mustangs of Utah and Colorado and Nevada, and these they're feral domesticates essentially. And I understand that a lot of these horses have been feral and breeding in the wild for quite some time, if not centuries, but technically they're feral domesticates. They're not wild in the proper definition.
Mm. Tell me about zebras. How closely related to horses?
So they're related. I mean, depending on the line, the ass is closer related to the horse than the zebra, but they're in the same genus of Equus. So the closest relatives of the horse are asses and zebras. And then if we go to the next level of taxonomy, the closest relatives to the horse of the odd-toed ungulates, there's only 17. So the seven species of Equus, and then rhinoceroses and tapirs are the next closest related animals to the horse.
Mm. So you're saying the word ass, that's the scientific term, right?
Correct. Or donkeys, yeah.
Donkeys, as we know them.
Asinus is the proper term, or asses, yes.
Yeah. And so just, I guess, one more question on this. As we know, just to nail this down, the mule is offspring of a horse and an ass.
Yes, but they can't reproduce to produce fertile offspring. So they're a dead end, I guess, lineage. They're a man-made creation, if you will. Just like horses, when we make breeds, they're not separate species. So the tiny horse, those little tiny horses that weigh, 40, 50 pounds, and the horses that weigh upwards of 2,000, 3,000 pounds, they're the same species, just like we have Paris Hilton's teacup poodle that weighs less than a pound. I'm joking. And then we have these giant, St. Bernards that are well over, 100, 200 pounds. They're the same species. They're just different breeds. And that's human manipulation. Mm-hmm. That's our wonderful imagination. And just because anti-logic that creates these tiny poodles like Paris Hilton bombs around in her purse, that technically is a Siberian gray wolf, of which is the ancestor of all domesticated dogs.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Timothy Weingard. He is a New York Times bestselling author of 5 books, including The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. The new book is The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity. Great read, fascinating book, The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity. So Timothy Weingard, I want to read just a sentence or two here. Without the horse's presence, the decisive battles recited in textbook and bedtime stories would have been small skirmishes or family feuds. And you're going to talk about legendary exploits of Alexander the Great, William the Conqueror, Genghis Khan, etc. So you started talking about this a little bit before the break. Maybe take Alexander the Great. Tell me how the horse entered into his conquering of so much territory.
Well, Alexander's whole life really is dominated by the horse. Certainly from a young age, he's acknowledged by his peers and the public both alike as being a horse whisperer almost immediately. And when he's 12, he tames his horse, Bucephalus, who's this massive, massive stallion who's with him for the rest of his life. And Bucephalus dies in India at the end of his, the eastern limit line, if you will, of Alexander's empire. Alexander uses cavalry in a very, very unique way, because his army he's always outnumbered in every battle, whether it's 2-1, 3-1. But his ingenious use of cavalry and his perfect timing of when and where to use it gives him a decisive advantage over his enemies, whether that's Darius III or Darius, depending on how you pronounce it, of Persia, or the Scythians, or eventually King Porus and his elephants in India. So it's his ingenious use of cavalry and when and where to use it, and his flanking techniques that set him apart and allow him to conquer such a vast empire so quickly as well. And that is a testament to the speed of the horse and the speed at which his very small army could travel. But the important thing about Alexander is not so much the idolatry that we kind of give him, or that his the great almost rolls off our tongues like a viable surname now. It's that what he did, because he was an academic as well, is his conquering of this vast empire, the Hellenic Empire, allowed the flourishing and cross-pollinization of ideas from the East and the West. And that's really his legacy as academia, and the construction of libraries and the copying of books into different languages. And that's his legacy. And it's still a legacy that we benefit from today.
Let's bring the things back to the Americas. Tell me about the Native American cultures, their interaction with horses. Where did that begin, do we think?
So, as I mentioned earlier, the horse went extinct in the Americas across the Western Hemisphere roughly 9,000 years ago, and it was reintroduced to the Americas by Columbus on his second voyage. So it makes the hop from the island of Hispaniola to Cuba and then into Mexico, thanks to Cortez. And then from Mexico, it spreads north to the Spanish limit line, which is really Santa Fe in New Mexico. And from Santa Fe, it radiates out across the western portion of the United States and southern Canada very quickly. And obviously, indigenous peoples, like peoples all over the Eurasian steppe, quickly realize the benefit to horses. So they attain them, whether through trade, theft, or gathering wild horses or feral horses from the plains. And what this does is, we often think, you know, with the Columbian Exchange and the arrival of Europeans, as I mentioned, guns, germs, and steel, indigenous peoples have no immunity to European diseases, and roughly 95% of them perish within in the first 250 years of contact from disease. So within all this negative influence of the arrival of Europeans, we often, the popular conception is that horses were the sole benefit that indigenous peoples received from this Columbian Exchange or from Europeans. And that's actually not true. It's quite the opposite. What the horse does is it introduces capitalism to indigenous cultures, and it completely upends their egalitarian socioeconomic conventions. It upends gender roles. It upends marriage practices. It upends military practices. It upends everything. And so it's actually part and parcel of the larger subjugation of indigenous peoples is their wholesale adoption of an equestrian culture. And it transforms their society in very negative ways, actually. And they're hunting bison at exponential rates. It's in the industrial harvesting of bison to feed the commercial or capitalist fur trade, something that didn't exist before Europeans and the arrival of the horse. So the Comanche, for example, are slaughtering upwards in their peak years of 575,000 bison a year on the southern plains. And we see this repeated a little bit later in the chronology of Manifest Destiny, if you will, on the northern plains with the Lakota Sioux. So it ultimately upends their society and creates divisions of hierarchy, social hierarchy, which the Canadian and American administrations use as a subjugation and divide and conquer strategy. So it's actually not enough uplifting or beneficial element to the indigenous peoples of the plains, quite the opposite. And as I mentioned, I put it along with, you know, Jared Diamond's trifecta of guns, germs, and steel. To that, I add horses.
I'd like to have you tell me just briefly about the Great Manure Crisis of 1894. This is, I think we, over that divide the last 100 years in internal combustion engine, we have trouble visualizing, smelling, as it were, the world, the world of 100 or so years ago.
Yeah, this was, I don't want to give away too much or not acknowledge the other chapters in the book that I, you know, I love researching and writing. I love the whole process and all the chapters are great. But I think the research and writing for this particular chapter, which I call Spiritual Machines, The Supremacy of the Horse, it was one of my favorites, if not my favorite. So we think, you know, we have problems with our own primary form of transportation in the form of emissions and pollution with fossil fuels. But the same thing existed with the primary form of transportation, you know, in the late 1800s with the horse. So if we think of, again, the horse, if you take away everything we use trains, planes, automobiles for today, the horse provided that function for society 100, 120 years ago. So when we're talking about these urban centers, they're crawling with horses. New York City in the 1890s has somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 horses. Now think of the amount of manure and urine, not to mention the dead horses themselves, that are covering and carpeting the streets of these urban centers in the United States, Canada, across Europe, London, across the world. It is remarkable. And for the most part, they just shoveled the manure to the side. And so there were manure piles upwards of 60 feet lining the sidewalks or parks or alleyways of these cities. And it's precisely why when we think of the movies and Seinfeld TV shows in New York City, we see these brownstone row houses where there's stairs that lead up to the first floor. And that's simply because you wanted to rise above this sea of fecal stew and filth that was just omnipresent across these urban centers. And it's very hard for us to imagine that now from a visual or, as you say, smell standpoint, not to mention the disease environment that this would have created with cholera and Giardia and E. coli across these urban landscapes. It's it's something that the movies of this time period, like our movies today that depict this time period, do not do justice to whatsoever, because the streets are way too clean.
Yeah, that's, I guess that's a good point. Finally, just have 30 seconds or so. What do you most hope people take away from this, this book? What's the big takeaway?
It's just a unique way to look at our own history through a different lens. We often assign all the agency to our historical events, to our wonderful men and women of history, but that's often not the case. External factors play a huge role in shaping and influencing and impacting our history. And so looking through the lens of how the horse created, our modern world is a unique way to look at history. It's a fun way to look at history. And I mean, at the end of the day, I hope readers enjoy the book, and I hope they learn from it and learn that we're not this omnipotent species, and often our hubris gets in the way when we look back and think how great we are. But we had a lot of help along the way, for better or for worse, from, thousands of generations of horses who were conscripted to do our bidding, whether noble or nefarious, and they had no choice in the matter as well. And certainly we see that with this First and Second World Wars, when we're talking about 16 million horses in the First World War used and 8 million dead. That's certainly not their will. But I hope people just enjoy it, and the ultimate goal is to enjoy learning.
Well, it's a fascinating book. It's out now. The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity. The author is Timothy Weingard. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah. Appreciate it. Thanks, everybody.
Every rural person and place has a story. Change is part of that story. Rural Utah at a Crossroads is part of the Smithsonian Traveling Exhibit Crossroads, Change in Rural America, which explores the changing meaning of rural life and identity. Utah Humanities is touring Crossroads to 8 rural communities across Utah in 2024. As part of the tour, Utah Humanities and Utah Public Radio are partnering with exhibition hosts to interview local residents about change in their communities. This interview was recorded at the Wasatch County Library in Heber City, Utah.
My name is Catherine Berg, and I was born and raised in Heber. All my life, I've lived in rural Utah. I started teaching at Richfield High School, and I was the physical education teacher, and I taught there for 2 years. And then I moved to Orem Alpine School District. I loved that district. I taught at Orem Junior High for 7 years, and then I went to Cedar City and became associated with Southern Utah University, and I was there for 33 years. And there, I was a coach. I coached everything, because that's when everything started for women. And then from the beginning, I was over women's athletics. And later on, I became the associate director of athletics over all sports, except I never was over men's basketball. It was hard for the football coaches to have me kind of in charge and directing them occasionally. But I had great opportunities. The last sport that I coached was women's gymnastics, but I had the opportunity to coach basically everything in the women's program. There weren't very many, I don't even know what the right word, concessions made for women to do anything. And in the beginning, the kids paid their way. We had one set of uniform for team sports. We had one set of warm-ups. We practiced in the beginning. I was the coach. I taught a full day. We'd start practicing one sport at 6 o'clock in the morning, because there was usually two going a season. Then we'd begin our second practice after open recreation, which meant mainly men, at 9 o'clock at night. So my days were pretty long. Changing minds is tough. Money is slim. Splitting money up so all can have the opportunity was really, really hard. But it happened, and it's better, but not complete yet. And it won't be in my lifetime, I'm sure. But it's about 900% better. It's just as meaningful and as important for them as it is for the young boys. Absolutely is. Gives them opportunities to develop skills, to develop social skills, to develop leadership skills, to develop skills that will help them in their careers. I have had the opportunity, not so much in Richfield, I was just 21, but when I everywhere else I have taught, I've had the opportunity to work in city or county government as on a committee or being actively engaged in something. So to be able to participate and to see change and to have a say on even a limited basis on how some of that change was coming about has been a great thing. And I'm grateful for that. I'm really an optimistic person, thinking that things will come along and things will change. Things will be good because this is such a beautiful place. People here are beautiful. People, we've had a surge of people moving in. And a lot of times, people moving in bring things with them, both good and not so good. And that brings enrichment. So we don't want to lose that, but we want to maintain who we are. I hope we continue to grow in love and congeniality and services that will bless and strengthen people and be a place for people who want to come to recreate, because it is a recreation tourist place now, but that we do those things with, I don't know whether you call it panache or what, but just do it well. I really hope that.
Rural Utah at a Crossroads is produced by Maya Shumway. It is a collaboration between Utah Public Radio, Utah Humanities, and the community hosts of Crossroads, Change in Rural America, a Smithsonian Museum on Main Street exhibition made possible in the Beehive State by Utah Humanities. Support for Museum on Main Street has been provided by the United States Congress. Broadcasts of Rural Utah at a Crossroads on UPR is supported by our members,